Tamara Thomas, Editor-in-Chief of UrbanHealthToday.com, part of the DocWire family of medical news sites, and I want to thank you for tuning in to Urban Health Weekly. Our goal each week is to keep you informed of the latest in health and medical news right from today's headlines. It's time to empower yourself with open conversations about your medical care with news that matters to you. So are you ready? Let's get started speaking with Cindy Barassi, president of the Colon Cancer Foundation. She's here to talk about the new guidelines for colorectal cancer screening and the importance of getting screened. Thanks for talking with me today, Ms. Barassi.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get started with the first and most important question. What are the new guidelines for colorectal cancer screening?
Well, we're very excited that the new guidelines from the USPSTF are screening begins at age 45. For Americans at average risk for colorectal cancer rather than age 50. And this means that an additional 21 million Americans can now be screened for colorectal cancer.
Can you talk about the data that led to the decision to lower the age for first colorectal cancer screening from 50 to 45?
Sure. It is a rather complex way of analyzing data. And it actually started almost a decade ago, I have to be honest. Our organization has been looking at the data alongside epidemiologists from the American Cancer Society going back, again, almost a decade. We have actually been hosting a summit called the Early Age Onset Colorectal Cancer Summit. This was actually our seventh summit in May. And we've started seeing the trend of younger and younger Americans showing up with the disease about 10 years ago. And we use what's called the SEER registry, housed by the National Cancer Institute. And then we also use something called CISNET. And researchers at the American Cancer Society actually started looking at that data and changed their guidelines about 3 years ago as a result of a summit that we held with them. We were very excited, but the USPSTF Preventative Task Force did not change their guidelines, as you know, until this year. And that's what most insurers go by. The payers don't really go by, you know, don't change their rules and their payments until USPSTF changes their guidelines. That's what's so exciting about the change this year. And they use the same data to do their modeling and statistics, and that's what changes their guidelines. The other thing that they take into consideration is, of course, the ability for our healthcare system to handle the onloading of an additional 21 million adults to get screened. Because you have to remember that right now, nearly a third of the Americans over the age of 50 aren't already getting screened. So you throw in another 21 million Americans, 45 and older, that's a huge population to get screened. So that's another consideration for them.
So colorectal cancer patients are being diagnosed younger, as you pointed mm-hmm. out. I read that the American College of Gastroenterology made the recommendations in 2005 and then in 2008 again to lower the screening age because of the increased risk they were seeing. So it's curious that the USPSTF didn't take that up until so many years later. But, you know, better late than never.
Their cycle for changing their guidelines is frustratingly slow. It was very frustrating for us, all the organizations in the colorectal cancer community, to have to watch and wait for this as we watch so many young patients die. To be quite honest with you, we actually see patients die, sometimes multiple patients that we know a week, every day. And we get to know these patients and it's heart-wrenching. And, you know, we know the parents, you know, we actually know parents that lose patients, you know, their sons and daughters as young now as 18 and 16. So it is really frustrating to wait for these lines to take place. And then it's even frustrating now, now that this has taken place, the insurers aren't responsible for starting the payments until 2023. So yes.
Really?
So, yes. So now it's, you know, now it's us putting the pressure on the insurers to get on the ball and start the payments as soon as possible and not wait until the last possible moment to implement the payments for these screenings.
Is that not to take the time, or is that across?
That's universal. Yes. Really? So now it's up to every state and it's up to every insurer, you know, so.
Right. I'm curious with this data. The National Cancer Institute is saying that these numbers are going to double by 2030. With that data in mind, why not age 40?
So this is an equally frustrating rationale. So what they look at is life years earned and life years lost and the net result and what we would get if we started screening earlier. And that's really the rationale. It's quite frustrating as an individual to think that they're looking at, you know, global public health on that scale, but that's honestly one of the largest considerations for it. But I want you to keep in mind that the current guidelines still recommend, even if we're not starting screening at age 40, the current guidelines do recommend that we be diagnosing based on symptoms. And those are current guidelines. And that's always been the case. So even if, you know, we were starting screening at age 50 before, doctors, primary care physicians still should have been looking for symptoms and signs for decades. And they weren't necessarily doing that. And that's something that we have to be doing a much better job of, as you know.
You know, I read an interesting story recently in one of the health blogs about a young lady who was 27 years old. And sorry, this is a slightly off topic, but it is, you
it's
know,
okay.
What you're talking about. And she went to the gastroenterologist because she was having pain. She had trouble eating and she lost a significant amount of weight without trying. I guess because of her age and because of her weight, the doctor dismissed her concerns and said, oh, it's great that you've lost all this weight. Nothing to worry about. I'm not going to do any screening. You're young. You've lost all this weight. It's a blessing that you can't eat solid food. And it turned out she got a second opinion. And it turned out that she had a humongous tumor and she had stage 3 cancer, which thankfully she got treated for. The tumor was removed. And she's, you know, on the mend now. But that I wonder if that's, you know, something that young people should be worried about with early onset. You know, the youth being, you know, being dismissed, like, oh, you're young and healthy. You know, I wonder if that's what happened to Chadwick Boseman in any event. So what do you think is driving this trend of younger and younger people turning up with cancer?
So that's actually one of the most important things that we look at every year with our summit, and not just the day of the summit, but all year round. You know, we are looking into research as to why this is happening. And, you know, just a startling statistic for you. So anyone born after the 1990s is 2 times more likely to be diagnosed with colorectal cancer and 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with rectal cancer, which is startling. It's a startling statistic for the public health community. And even, you know, someone who's not in the public health realm, those are startling numbers. And then, of course, the other startling statistic I don't like to quote, but, you know, have to quote, is that the most rapidly rising rates are in between the ages of 20 and 29. And again, those are more pronounced in the rectal side of things. And that's just those are just devastating statistics. But we don't know. We have some inklings. They are spending a lot of time looking at the food we eat. So is it changes in what we eat? Is it genetically modified foods which are affecting the gut and the microbiome? Is it the environment? We're looking very closely at epigenetic changes, which may be, you know, driving. So is it a large global epigenetic change in our systems? Or are these young people genetically predisposed to develop cancer? And then something in the environment triggers their genetics younger than, say, someone who wouldn't get this until they were in their 60s. Because it is more likely to be, in the past, you were more likely to be diagnosed with colon cancer in your 60s and 70s.
Right.
So we don't know if these colon cancers, when you're diagnosed when you're young, it could be that it's an entirely new disease. We just don't know yet. We do know that some of these can be much more aggressive tumors and lesions than in those that are diagnosed later on. The other very sad thing is that, you know, you were referencing the 27-year-old. Most of these cases are diagnosed at a very late stage, and we know those what those prognoses are. That's a much poorer prognosis because of the late stage diagnosis and a higher death rate. And it's because they are often dismissed because they're young. And so we have to change that. We really do have to change the whole conversation around this, that you can get colon cancer at any age and you can have the symptoms at any age for colon cancer.
So I know ASCO came out a couple of years ago saying that all alcohol, well, they've changed it over the years, but they've upgraded it to say that all alcohol consumption is carcinogenic. That might be another factor I hope that researchers are looking at. I know that the research community is kind of grasping right now, like, what is going on? What is creating this tidal wave?
Right.
Can you talk about the factors driving the rise in disparity in colorectal cancer? For example, I was just reading about colorectal cancer hotspots throughout the country. Places where you're, doctors are finding clusters of people turning up with colorectal cancer diagnoses.
Again, it could be, well, there are multiple factors here. We actually do find familial links in, you know, hotspots with familial links. They're called gastrointestinal hereditary syndromes, where they go back in generations and they find something like Lynch syndrome. It's similar to the BRCA gene on the colorectal cancer side. So that's one possibility. Two is health equities and disparities, where you've got, you know, a very low income, you know, economically distressed community, where there's, you know, low access to care, or they're in a rural setting where it's difficult to get to screening. For example, let's say they're in a very rural area and there's hardly any, you know, there isn't screening there. There's the language barrier, for example. There's education around the food we eat. Obesity is a factor. We do see very different rates of diagnosis, for example, diagnosis and mortality in the Black community, as well as one very alarming statistic is in the American Indian and Alaska Native populations. So in the Black community, we see 20% higher diagnosis, and we see a 40% higher mortality rate, unfortunately. And then we see double that in the American Indian and Native Alaskan population. And the public health and epidemiologists are digging into both of those populations. And all of that has to be addressed immediately. And actually, we're as a foundation working, for example, here in New York City with one of the largest health systems in the country to directly address that issue.
According to the Journal of Clinical Gastroenterology, lack of screening seems to also be high up there in terms of disparity rates for white people versus people of color.
It could be lack of screening. It could be. There is also demonstrated cultural barriers to, you know, not wanting to undergo a colonoscopy, for example. But one thing that has been highlighted in the current guidelines, and even, for example, here in New York City, we're stressing, and around New York City, there are multiple options for getting screened other than colonoscopy. And especially now that we've been so hard hit by COVID and screening basically came to a screeching halt, it's had a devastating effect on colonoscopy. So there are multiple mechanisms for getting screened at home, as a matter of fact. So you can start the process with an at-home FIT test. There's CT colonography. You're still doing the prep, but you're not undergoing a colonoscopy. So they're just as effective. The colonoscopy is still the gold standard, because if you're going in there and they find something, they can take care of it while they're in there. But there is a way for someone to get started with the screening process. And then, of course, if they find something, they would have to undergo the colonoscopy and take care of it.
Well, let's stay with that for a second. So there's colonoscopy. Mm-hmm. There's the virtual colonoscopy, which I actually just had one of those 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
But you know, my doctor didn't even know about virtual colonoscopy. I guess what he never heard of it. You know, he actually, you know, looked it up on his computer while I was there explaining.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So there's colonoscopy. There's virtual colonoscopy. There's also, what is it called? Is it called DNA, stool DNA, right?
Right. There's stool DNA, which the big name is Cologuard. We work very closely with the manufacturer Exact Sciences. And most people know it by the dancing white box on the TV screen. Yeah. And you can actually get that right shipped right to your home.
I guess I'm wondering why providers not having conversations about these alternatives, because there is a lot of fear sometimes, you know, in terms of the lack of screening. There is that fear, you know, for a man, it might be emasculating to undergo the procedure. Some people may be concerned about the anesthesia, being unconscious. There's also a fear of, take your pick. I have the BRCA2 mutation, which puts me at high risk for colorectal cancer, as well as breast cancer and a host of other cancers. So this is something that's kind of near and dear to me. So why is it that doctors are not having these conversations with patients and saying, hey, look, you know, because with breast cancer, there's so much conversation. The information is just abundant. And I don't see that in the colorectal cancer space. And given the almost epidemic numbers of people, you know, coming, I mean, 21 million is nothing to sneeze at. Why aren't doctors doing a better job of educating people about their alternatives for some form of screening, any form of approved screening?
Your guess is as good as mine. You know, I tend to be, people tend to look at me kind of sideways in this space, because I think it's time to get a little loud, almost like the breast cancer advocates got loud in this space like 20 years ago. It was probably about 2 decades ago.
That sounds about right. 20
or even, you know, even the AIDS advocates, you know, HIV AIDS.
30 years.
I'm going to equate it to that, where they started demanding that we talk about this. It didn't have the same cultural repercussions, I guess, in the HIV environment, but you're right. So I see breast cancer being discussed on the soccer fields at the age of 6. Yeah. So, and little boys, I mean, the whole universe is talking about it. And we talk about this in the colon cancer space. It's like we're talking about it in an echo chamber. It's just, we talk amongst ourselves about it.
Okay.
And so we have to get a little bit of activism going here, if that's the right word. But you're right. We have to be talking about all the alternatives. One question came to my mind. Did your OBGYN, when you were diagnosed with BRCA, talk to you about getting a colonoscopy?
He did not.
So why not?
Exactly.
Why not? Why wouldn't he, if you were more susceptible to colon cancer, why wouldn't he have done that? Why wouldn't any woman who was diagnosed with BRCA be told about that? And why wouldn't and we're already talking to the ACOG, which is American College of OBGYNs here in the New York City area, about them getting involved, because they know how to handle ovarian, you know, cervical, breast cancer. So why not get them involved in talking about colon cancer? They're a natural fit. You know, they see women from a very young age, you know, their entire lives. You know, it's finding men, but.
Yeah. You know, who spoke to me about it was actually my breast oncologist.
Mm.
So then is it incumbent upon patients? Then what's the approach that we take in terms of getting the word out? Do we educate patients more? Or should providers be the ones to be educated so that they in turn educate the patients?
Well, I think it's two-pronged. I think we need to go, you know, system down for the providers. That's why I'm very excited to be talking to you today with your connection into the provider space.
Yes.
I think educating the providers is critical on as broad a scale and as active a scale as possible and as quickly as possible, because the epidemic, you know, public health will not call it an epidemic. I'll tell you that right now. They are loath to call it an epidemic. That is out of their mouths. They will not do that.
I'll tell you. And I agree that it is. I mean,
yes, yes. They will not call it that. When I see 18, 16, 14 year olds die of colon cancer, that's heart wrenching. Yeah. So something has to be done. For example, in the cervical world, they were really successful in arming the patients. And then go back to HIV and breast cancer. They were really successful at arming the patients and activating them.
Right.
And with information to demand awareness, and turn them into their own advocates and demand change, you know, within the primary care space. And when I talk about primary care, I mean any provider who's touching a patient before they could be diagnosed. So it's, I'm even going back to, for example, your pediatrician to your primary care provider, because, for example, if you have the BRCA gene or you have the Lynch mutation, that's going to change when your child is starting to get screened. And it could start as early as you're going to have that conversation when they're young,
right? You
know, starting when they're a child. Is it this gets into bioethics, but is it 16, 17, 18, 19, 20? It could be that young. We're thinking about, you know, some of these mutations are showing up and they're skipping a generation. And we don't know why that's happening. Or it's just showing up out of the blue. You know, they have these genetic mutations and it hasn't been in any of their family members that they know of. So why is that going on? No one in the space knows the answer yet. That's going to have an impact now on their children. And that's really important. The family history is another really important way for us to prevent this disease, which isn't being done by the primary care space either. We know for a fact that they aren't taking family histories, and they aren't, for example, when someone's diagnosed, they aren't explaining how important it is for them to now tell their entire family and then do what's called cascade testing and test the entire family for that mutation and their children, because that would change their risk.
You know, I think about cervical cancer, for example, and HPV and the link. And I wonder, do you think, and this might be slightly controversial to ask you, but we're talking about it, so let's talk about it. Do you think that if there were pharmaceuticals directly related to the colorectal cancer, that there would be a bigger push for education? I'm wondering.
Oh, like if there was a
right,
cure,
like if there were a drug,
yeah,
would be more research and more dollars and more more public awareness of, you know, the disease.
I wouldn't say no.
Not an accusation, just a thought.
I wouldn't say no. Thank you for your patience with the dogs and the moving.
Oh,
around.
You're. No problem. I put my dogs downstairs because I know exactly how to let them out a little bit. But right. Thank you so much for your time. And
thank you.
You know, we will be in touch. And,
okay.
You know, have a great day. Thank you.
You too. All right. Bye-bye.
From the Lower Nine to Uptown. Mid-City to the West Bank. We got you covered, New Orleans. WHIV 102.3 FM.
During the height of the pandemic in 2020, small clinics, pharmacies, and underserved rural communities were shut out of receiving personal protective equipment, or PPE, as suppliers gave preferential treatment to large hospital systems. Enter Rhino Medical, a multinational, majority-minority-owned healthcare product distribution company based in Columbia, South Carolina, providing medical products for hospital systems, long-term care facilities, and to homes across the country. Joining me are Lance Brown and Elliot Haney, CEO and COO, respectively, of Rhino Medical, to talk about their role in filling the needs of underserved facilities and communities during the most distressing period of the pandemic and beyond. Thanks for talking with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
It's great to have you here. Let's get started. So Rhino Medical was born out of a need among smaller health systems and pharmacies to get their hands on PPE during the pandemic. But you were running a payment processing company. You were running Swipe Fast. Can you talk about how it came to you that this was a need you could fill? How did you make the transition from finance to logistics?
Sure. That's a question we get asked commonly because it's such a complete opposite industry. So it really goes down to relationships. So one of the guys that we hired from Swipe Fast, Tripp Robinson, who's a partner in Rhino, he's spent 20 plus years in medical sales, and he had a lot of like deep rooted, longstanding relationships with hospitals here in our state. And even though we were a processing company, our philosophy and the way that we approach business is the same as versus the relationship base. And with us in our state, we were getting everybody was getting hit hard, but from an allocation standpoint, we were in really bad shape. So if you had a relationship with previous longstanding relationships, even though we were in a completely different industry. And then the other part of your question, you were asking about logistics. That's something we were learning like on the fly, really. I mean, I have a finance background and that didn't know anything about logistics. But when you're thrown into the middle of something, especially during a global pandemic, you tend to pick up fairly quickly how to do and what to do.
I guess I'm wondering where the kernel of the idea came from. How did it occur to you to make that switch? Like, you know, this is something we can do. How did that happen?
Part of it was if you have a friendship and you have a friend that is in need, and let's use the word desperate, to find anything, and you're willing to help. So we were with Tripp's relationships, we were kind of asked to come off the sidelines and see if we could help. And we were developing, and this is the origin of it, is that their original traditional vendors that they were going to put them on allocation. So they could only get what they were told that they could get. So if you're normally getting 10 of something and you can only get one, then you have to look for alternative sources. And then you start looking into your relationships and say, who do you know that may can help? And that's kind of how we were able to get introduced to a completely different industry. And then with our business backgrounds, and Elliot spent 10 plus years in manufacturing, finance, banking. So we just kind of approach a completely different industry with a fresh set of lens. And we didn't know any bad habits because we were building everything for the first time. And we just knew how to treat people. And then we knew how to source. And from that, it led us to develop a pretty robust supply chain.
During the height of the pandemic, news coverage was filled with stories about hospitals being short on much needed PPE. But the need was actually greatest among small health systems, pharmacies, and underserved rural communities. So since you were on the ground during this time, can you offer any insight into what that looked like? What did you witness happening?
Yeah, so I guess I can take that question. I like to think back when it all started. You were listening to the news, you heard about New York, the state of New York was where the epicenter of the pandemic.
Yes.
And going on. And, you know, the larger states, the bigger systems had priority over allocation. And even if you think about it from a business standpoint, you know, those medical supply companies or manufacturers are supporting those hospital systems that were spending more money, you know, and who did they choose to support? They chose to support those larger hospital systems. And so when you start thinking about, you know, smaller physician offices, dental offices, they didn't have the same buying power as, let's say, a hospital. And so what we saw was they weren't being supported. And that was an opportunity for us to come and fill a big need.
And I think also in addition to that is that everything was still coming from one part of the world. So 95% of all of the N95s were being made in China. And kind of it's a direct correlation. So we're talking about rural healthcare systems and hospitals compared to some of the larger systems. Same thing with manufacturing, right? So a lot of the smaller manufacturers that were making a completely different good or product had to pivot. They had to pivot too because of COVID, because whatever they were making before, and it could have been the, you know, family business that's been in business for 30 or just say decades. What they did in order to keep their lights on and to keep their people paid, they started making PPE that our country needed. And then it allowed someone like us to come in and to develop a supply chain with guys who really needed the support and who customers who really needed the product. And the other thing I think that's really important is that even if a smaller rural system could find it, the minimum orders that they were required to purchase is just unrealistic for them. Like, for instance, normally they may only order 10 cases of something, but because of the pandemic, in order to get what you needed, they may have to order a container, like 2,500 cases. So it just didn't make from a resource standpoint or financial standpoint, even if they could find it, they couldn't afford to buy it because of the minimum requirements. And we were able to come in and we would break down a case. So if you needed a box of 20 masks, we would sell you a box of 20. If you needed 700, if you needed 10,000, we were able to meet them where they were, and it allowed us to create a lane for ourselves.
So it sounds like you guys offered flexibility that the smaller systems needed, which is great. What's allocation? You use that term.
Yeah. So allocation is almost like rationing out. So if you, and a lot of times what happens with the manufacturers, they went on 2019 data. So what you were purchasing on 2019 is how they determine who got what, and how much of what they got. So, and everybody was on the allocation. So that meaning like if you needed 100 cases because everything was limited and in short supply, you may only get 10 cases. And that's what allocation is. And there may be a better definition that you can.
No, what Lance said is absolutely right. They went off of your 2019 purchase history. So if you purchase 10 cases of masks a month, that's how much they were allocating you. They didn't change the need obviously increased 3 to 4 right. times. So if you can only get 100% of what you purchased in 2019, then you still have, let's say, a 70% gap in your supply. And so that, again, that's what created the lane for us and how we were able to get into the market.
And you would see it was sometimes a 7 to 10x increase of what they normally needed. So if you were only able to get what you purchased in 19, but you need 6 times or 10 times that number, then that's what really created the crisis that we're in from a supply standpoint.
Yeah, and a lot of the manufacturers that we work with, it's not like you can just flip a switch. They can't, you know, I spent 10 years in manufacturing. It's impossible for you just to say, we're gonna make 7 times as much as we have. You got to think about the people resources that it takes, the additional assets and equipment that it takes to run those machines and to build out those products. It just can happen. And so that was one of the biggest issues.
And that's where the bigger the state, the bigger the system, the more resources you had. And then the smaller the state, the smaller the systems, the more rural, the less you had to work with. And that's kind of what created the issue in itself, is because if you were a small system in rural South Carolina or Georgia, you didn't have the buying power, like Elliot said, and the manufacturers that you buy from. I mean, if you only have one piece of bread and you have to share it with all your customers, you're probably going to feed the ones who spend the most amount of money with you first and the most. And that's kind of what was happening with supply chain, is that they had to pick and choose who and what they could allow to sell to their customers. But somebody was going to be left, you know, at the bottom. And we recognize that need, and we're able to help that particular demographic.
Now, we literally had surgery centers shutting down because they couldn't find the resources that they needed, the supplies that they needed. For us, that was, I mean, it was insane, kind of the challenges that they were going through on simple things like a mask. Can I explain?
Well, let's talk about that for a second. Let's talk about, because a lot of these mid-sized healthcare centers were forced to close their doors due to the pandemic. And so how did that affect your business, if at all? And do you think any of them will come back?
Yeah, so I mean, we were born out of the pandemic. Right. So all business was new business. But what we recognize is that the small to mid-size is where we were able to scale and able to create value. And we've been able to still stay here. Because from day one, we understand that we got the opportunity, and it's a humbling business because of the COVID, but we want COVID to end just like everybody else. So it's up to us as leaders of a company that we feel like we're buried in entry is pretty low. We have the opportunity to build something that's sustainable after COVID. So in order to do that, we treated our customers as like, we want your long-term business. We want after COVID, and you have your pick of the litter, you can go to whoever you want to, because there's no allocation issues. Would you still choose Rhino? So it's up to us to create value when they needed us the most, because sometimes during the crisis is when folks get taken advantage of because they don't have any other options. And I think we treated people fairly. We really value the relationship. So even as things opened back up and they were able to go back to their traditional vendors, we were there for them when they needed us the most, and we took care of them, we didn't take advantage of them. So it's created recurring opportunities in business for us.
So did it affect your business or did it not affect your business?
I think it impacted our business in a positive way, because we've been able to kind of understand and see verticals that some of the bigger guys don't even, it may be a blind spot for them, or just maybe something they can't get to because of they have to worry about other things. And we understand it from the smaller systems and the more disadvantaged systems, there's tremendous opportunity.
And then, you know, the other thing is, and Lance and I were talking about it, when you start thinking about these smaller hospital and healthcare systems, they don't even get the same level of attention from those manufacturers. Every manufacturer has a sales rep, right? And that go visit these hospitals and healthcare systems, and they check on them and they make sure they're being taken care of. Some of these rural hospital systems don't even have a rep to follow up with them to see how they're doing, right? And so for us, what created a lane for us is that we were actively reaching out to these doctors' offices and hospital systems, these rural hospital systems that may not needed 30,000 boxes of gloves. They maybe only needed 100 cases of gloves. And so for us, we were able to, one, get them fair pricing during a time where pricing was a challenge, and two, give them reliable supply chain. Because and you start thinking about this, the procurement professionals with inside of those systems, they never had to strategically source for goods. They would go online to a McKesson or Medline and they would just place their order. They didn't know who to reach out to. They didn't know who they could trust. They didn't have any of that insight. And for us, that really created a lane.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, is that before COVID, they didn't have anybody that was calling on them or that was checking in on them. So when COVID, and it's still happening, those, they didn't have anybody before. So now they're literally just left to fend for themselves. And that's when whatever resources they had, whether it be a new startup company or a pre-existing relationship, they gave the opportunity. And then also, there's a lot of bad actors that anytime there's a crisis, there's a lot of bad actors that's going to pop up too to take advantage of the situation or the crisis. So not only did they have many resources to start with, but they had to entrust someone that they never really met or hasn't been in the industry long to take care of their investment. And you had a lot of people that took money and never produced, never had a supply chain, and they really just took advantage of a system that was already like down and was kind of like kicking the water down. So having that financial background and being able to take that responsibility, we knew that anytime that someone entrusted us with their investment, their money, in order to source a particular good, you know, that's something that we took, you know, very seriously, and we knew how important it was to protect that.
So these smaller places don't have a procurement department that is dedicated to making sure that the centers and these facilities have supplies on hand. And so you guys kind of came in and sort of did that for them.
Yep. So they have a lot of them have an administrator that wears many hats, mm-hmm. right? We're talking about resources. They could be spread thin, you know, and so they don't have someone like bigger hospital, like healthcare systems, like let's say Common Spirit or Advent Health. Like they don't have a team dedicated to procuring their goods. They have an administrator, potentially a administrator, was purchasing those goods for them. Or in some cases, they have nurses that are purchasing.
Oh, wow.
So to Elliot's point, like the bigger systems have just specific catalogs that they only have to procure for. Like, so it may be only one item. Like you only work on this one particular item, and that's the only thing that you worry about procurement. Then we have a rural system in our state that we recently helped, and we were working directly with the chief nursing officer. So there's a lot that she has on her plate. And she also has to worry about like procuring important devices and products for her system to be successful and be able to support their patients. So you see it from the bigger systems have all kinds of resources from infrastructure, and the smaller systems, you may have someone in offices like literally on Google, just trying to do the best that they can, and they don't know where to start.
I'm curious about, because a lot of people, you know, were furloughed, like non-essential staff were furloughed and were working from home. So talk to me about that part of it in terms of getting in touch with an administrator who might not have necessarily been at the center, who might have been working from home. How did you do that part? How did you reach people?
Yeah, so you know, in our business, it's really a customer interfacing job, right? I mean, you build credibility by meeting people, having face-to-face touch points. And so everything's been virtual for us since we haven't even been able to do a customer site visit because of COVID. And so for us, it was about leveraging technology and resources on, you know, who were responsible within those hospitals, reaching out to them. And then you can imagine during a time where there's a lot of chaos, there's a lot of fraud, it's hard to figure out who to trust, how to actually build those relationships and build those touch points. And so I think what we did really well early on is making connections and getting mentors and then people seeing that we built credibility with them, and they were in turn willing to introduce us to their network. And that's in a large part, that's kind of how it's been this entire time.
Yeah, so. For sure. And then just piggyback what Elliot's saying off of what Elliot's saying too, is that we brought in a guy that had 13 plus years calling, working with GPOs, group purchasing organizations, which a lot of these hospital systems are a part of. You know, you basically get better pricing and rates because of the strength of everybody that's a part of that particular, you know, association. And so he had been calling on GPOs for 13 years. So he had credibility. Again, like if you know somebody, even if you meet them 20 years later, if you had a positive experience with them and you valued their work, then you gave them opportunity. So that helped us. And then two, we've never pretended to be experts. We feel very confident where we are now from a knowledge standpoint. But even from the get-go, like we knew that we needed a lot of help. And when we would meet people, we're confident in ourselves. And we knew if we had an opportunity to face up, whether it be a Zoom call, which is really that was what it was, a Zoom call, then mm-hmm. we can kind of tell them about ourselves and our vision for what we wanted to do and how we can help. And then we were able to earn trust and earn business from that. And then a lot of times, even with hospital systems, if they saw some gaps that we had and some dots that needed to be connected, they made introductions for us. And then Elliot was really instrumental in getting us certified, our MBEs, Minority Business Enterprise Certificate. And through there came more introductions, because there's a lot of many hospital systems and healthcare systems and businesses in general have a diverse supplier spend goal. And it's really challenging to find qualified vendors that meet that. So from there, we had introductions. So it's really just networking, people believing in us, not necessarily through our industry experience in this particular industry, but just in general throughout our careers, believing in us and trusting us.
And the other part that I think it was really important is developing our supply chain, having a reliable supply chain that we could deliver on. And, you know, when we started a business, it was really brokering off of someone else's supply. And we didn't want to be dependent and relying upon those resources. We wanted to have our own direct manufacturing partnership and distributorship agreement set up in place. And so that's what we did. And that allowed us to bring credibility. Lance didn't tell you the entire story. You know, we started out of his, out of an office outside of the basement of his garage. And then within 6 months, you know, we grew so fast that now we're in a 12,000 square foot warehouse and office spaces where we actually distribute our products.
You guys are also, I saw the video, you guys are also pretty hands-on in terms of day-to-day operations. Talk about that a little bit.
After this interview, we'll take off this jacket, put on a different shirt, and then we'll be out in the warehouse wrapping pallets and making sure that the cases of glove and everything else get sent out. And you know what, I actually appreciate that, because everything that I've been a part of in my life from a career standpoint, I've started at an entry-level position. And there's no work that's beneath us, and it allows us to learn our business and a new business from the ground up. So we understand what it is from a logistics. We schedule trucks. We handle all the shipping. We got a team in place that everybody has a part that they play for us all to be successful. But Elliot and I will be out in the warehouse doing everything. We call on our customers. So there's nothing that we don't do because it's our business. And I actually think it's an advantage because we're not this big operation with a lot of overhead. We're able to move faster and more swifter to make decisions in our own business.
Yep. And the other part of that is when you're thinking about a startup business, right? We are competing with companies that have been here for 20, 30, 40 years. And so the resources that they have in place, the established customer base that they have in place, they, you know, their margins are high enough to where they can have more resources to support their business. And for us, we're lean. We only have 6 employees total within our business. And so we have to make sacrifices until we can build our customer base up to where we can have additional resources. And that means sometimes that, you know, we have a suit and tie on, and other days we have our cargo pants and a t-shirt, and we have to support our customers and getting the resources that they need. So for us, it's just about continuing to grow and doing whatever we can to support our customers.
And it's fun. I mean, it's really, honestly, it keeps you in tune. We talk to our customers, so we understand like the pains that they're going through, the challenges, and anything that we can do to help make their life easier. Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that's like really risking their lives. And if we can help support them, then it makes, Elliot says it all the time, like what we do, you feel it. It has purpose. Like you truly, it has purpose. Whether we're selling directly to a consumer or to an institution, a hospital or a smaller office that feels overlooked and that nobody really values their business because it may not be a lot, quote unquote, from a revenue standpoint. And we treat all of those folks the same. Like we get excited to send out one case is the same excited as we get out to send out 600 cases of something.
And you got physician offices and surgery centers that literally a day could be the difference. One day could be the difference in saving a life. That's how serious it is. So when we think about getting our products to our customers by any means necessary, you know, if that means that I have to wrap a pallet or load, we're going to do it.
Can you talk about the donation part? How did you get into donations and giving to the community?
Yes. I mean, it's just something that we've always, from before we had a customer, we said, you know, if we have the opportunity, especially during a global pandemic, because we started a business because of heartbreak of a lot of folks getting sick. So it's a humbling business to begin with. So if there's an opportunity for us to give back, we were doing it before COVID with other things, just our personal lives. But we understood that this may give us a bigger opportunity and a platform to impact more people. So as we grow, so will that. Now, our charitable contributions and just being able to be more involved, whether it be just time, it could be mentoring, could be whatever it is. It doesn't have to necessarily be like a commodity or a product. It could just be a bunch of different ways to make an impact in our community. And that's something that as we grow and continue to grow, that will as well.
But I guess I'm trying to find out how did you pinpoint where the need was?
Okay, I understand the question. So it really, the most underserved, the more rural, the school districts that really didn't have the resources. And in some cases, you can tell they were working on the budget because they were like, hey, I got to get it approved. But like, we may have to go at less because this is all we got. You know, like when someone genuinely needs help, we don't question whether or not they're asking for it just so they can, you know, get free stuff. It's like they genuinely need help. And those are the ones that we're more really attracted to help because they're underserved. And overlooked in a lot of instances.
Did you call on them or was it more of a situation of somebody sort of came to you and said, hey, look, these schools or this particular school, and there might be more like us, we really need supplies?
In some cases, we have relationships already established where, you know, we seek out to help underserved communities. So we reach out to those. Just to give an example, there's a school district here in Columbia, and we said, hey, we're really looking to make donations to underserved schools that may not have the same resources. Can you point us to which schools would need that? And then they would direct us to which schools would need it. Or maybe there are school districts that are just underserved in general. And so we made it a priority to deliberately donate to those school districts.
And then too, I mean, you get inspired by other people that are in a community that have been doing that work for a long time. And then you look for ways to collaborate with those folks.
Okay. Well, what's next on the horizon for Rhino Medical? I see you guys have a consumer section on your website, for example. What's next?
How do we continue to be sustainable? The pandemic is going to end. And so how do we continue to stay relevant? How do we increase our offerings to our customers? How do we continue to diversify what we offer? And then the second thing is, how do we be disruptive? How can we offer a product at a price that's competitive, even more competitive for these smaller systems to be able to purchase from? because I think we talked about it earlier, you know, the larger you are, the more products you buy, the better price that you get. So how can we give that similar pricing to those smaller systems? And for us, that's a key target customer base is those smaller systems.
I would just add, like, what's next for us is to continue to keep our head down and keep putting in the work. I mean, we're very ambitious, right? So we want to be the largest minority owned healthcare distributor, distribution company in the country. The biggest thing is, like, we want to become a dominant force. You know, Elliot mentioned being disruptive. That's kind of what we want to do. And we're already doing that. And we're seeing that, continuing to build really valuable relationships, doing things in community, growing our business, growing our distribution. The best thing about our story is that we started out with a nationwide footprint. Without knowing anything about the industry, our playground was the entire country. So now that we're starting to hone in and we understand the business, we understand the relationships, we understand what it takes, we're able to move more swiftly and we're able to continue to grow and scale. So that's what's next, is just to keep our head down, stay humble, find ways to be relevant, bring in new products, new ideas, be disruptive, all of those things, and still giving back.
Just one last question. Out of curiosity, what made you guys decide to spin off and do a consumer section?
So we've been very fortunate and blessed to be featured in some large publications, the largest being the New York Times. The biggest story on that particular article was that daily you could watch, you know, CNN. Sanjay Gupta was on CNN every day, and he would show an N95 mask, and he would say, "This is an N95, but you can't find them. So since you can't find them, here's other things you should use instead. Use this mask." And we were like, no, there's plenty of N95s available if you work with these local manufacturers who have answered the call, they got their NIOSH approval and are able to make them, and they have inventory, there's nobody's buying them. So that was a story, and that was a feature of the story, is that there's all of these US suppliers of N95 that nobody's supporting. So from that article, we had 50,000 hits on our website, and we had talked about maybe one day selling direct to consumers, but we didn't. It wasn't a focus at that point, but we had 50,000 hits on our website. We didn't have any way to capture that business. However, the best thing that ever happened was that we didn't have a way to capture sales from consumers, because we were able to hear their stories, like their unique perspectives of why it was important for them, everyday folks like you and I, to be able to get medical grade products and devices. And we heard stories from, I have stage 4 cancer, and I just want something that protects me between my treatments. You know, we had an older gentleman that wrote in, he's like, "Hey, I'm at the end of my rope and I don't want COVID to be the reason it takes me out. So like, if I can buy a actual medical grade mask from you, then it's helpful." So from there, Charles and Elliot, we built a Shopify site within a day, and then just start dinging. And then we realized there's a new vertical, there's a new opportunity for everyday consumers to be able to get medical grade equipment. And more importantly, even now, as the Delta variant is just raging through our communities.
Devastating.
Most folks don't have the proper PPE to take care of their loved ones. So if someone gets sick in your household, is your wife, your husband, or a loved one that's taking care of you? So they're taking care of their loved ones with COVID without the proper protection to protect themselves from getting COVID. So it's also important in that regard, is that you can also get something to protect yourself to help you care for a loved one more safely.
Well, thank you so much. I know you guys got to get back to it. Yeah, it was great talking to you today.
I gotta go wrap some pallets.
Don't put your back out.
I know. Thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for tuning in to Urban Health Weekly. I hope you enjoyed today's show and that you'll join me again next week for more medical news and topics that matter to you. For UrbanHealthToday.com, I'm Tamara Thomas, and I'll see you next time.